Brian Meacham is a presidential historian, contributing editor at Time, and an executive vice president and executive editor at Random House Publishing. John's 2009 bestseller, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, earned the Pulitzer Prize for biography. His other distinguished titles include Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship, and American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. A member of the Council on Foreign Relations and of the Executive Board of the Society of American Historians, Meacham is a regular guest on Morning Joe and also appears on Meet the Press, Charlie Rose, and other broadcasts. He is an editor-at-large of WNET Public Media, New York's public TV station. John served as managing editor of Newsweek for 8 years, then as editor from 2006 to 2010. He's a former editor of the Washington Monthly and began his career at the Chattanooga Times. Born in Chattanooga, Meacham graduated from the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee, with a degree in English literature. He's a former member of the Board of Trustees and of the Board of Regents of the University of the South. He's currently a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt. Meacham also serves on the Leadership Council of the Harvard Divinity School. He lives in Nashville and in Suwanee with his wife and children. Today, I'm excited to welcome John to the program to speak about his latest book, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Welcome, John, and thanks so much for joining us on the Book Report.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've done acclaimed books on Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Franklin Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill. Some would argue that George Herbert Walker Bush might not be as compelling. How would you answer?
Well, George Herbert Walker Bush thought that, too. He wrote me a letter after the Jackson book was published saying it's a little intimidating to follow in the steps of the lion, because I'd called the book American Lion. But I disagree. I disagree with him, and I disagree with people who would argue that. I think he's this incredibly significant American figure. In his life, we can see the development of the American century, the end of the American century in many ways. He's the last president of the greatest generation, first president of the post-Cold War world, someone who shaped the way we live now, both in terms of foreign policy and in terms of domestic policy, which he was actually pretty good at, despite the fact that no one thought so at the time, including him.
You begin the book with a quote from the man himself, "Moods come and go, but greatness endures." Would you say that Bush was a great president?
Yes, he was great and consequential. He was certainly the most significant one-term president since James K. Polk. Polk, of course, fought the Mexican War, achieving enormous territorial gains for the country. But what Bush did was helped manage the end of an existential human conflict. The Cold War, which is now largely forgotten, contained in it the threat of nuclear Armageddon. When George Bush became president on Friday, January 20th, 1989, nuclear Armageddon was a possibility. When he left, it was not. That alone would be worth a place in the historical record. If you add his domestic achievements, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act, the 1990 budget agreement that set the terms for the prosperity of the 1990s, you have a man who accomplished a great deal for the country.
How many years of research did you do before you started writing, and how much exposure did you have to the man himself?
I had an enormous amount of exposure to the president. First occurred to me to write a book like this 17 years ago, in 1998. By about 2006, he agreed to give me his White House diaries, his vice presidential diaries, and to open up the family. And in the last 3 or 4 years, and then I interviewed him in a formal sense on a number of occasions from 2006 to September 8th, 2015 was the last interview for this book. And so I had unlimited access to him, really, which has its ups and its downs. People could say I didn't throw a punch when I needed to. But at the end of the process, when I looked over what I'd done, I really believe in my heart that this is as close to the truth as I can get.
You know, the book was filled with wonderful photos, including some of he and his wife Barbara as a young couple. She was movie star gorgeous. Now when you think of Barbara Bush, it's white hair and white pearls. So talk a bit about their partnership.
Well, I don't think he would have been president without Barbara Bush. She ran that family. She kept the family together when he was on the road. He was a magnificent father when he was there, but he was not there. Barbara was the one who kept things together. That's his own account. Mrs. Bush, you're right, was a beautiful young woman and became a formidable woman. And even now, I was with them 2 weeks ago and spoke to her last week, actually. And she's just an amazingly intelligent, witty, perceptive person. And politicians' wives tend to fall into one of two categories, people who meddle perhaps a bit too much, and those who are quietly effective in advising their husbands, and she was in the latter category.
I never knew about the tragedy of his young daughter. How did that affect the family?
Well, the loss of Robin in 1953, George W. had been born in 46. Robin, Pauline Robinson Bush, was born in 1949. She died at the age of 4 of leukemia. It shattered the family, but they kept going. I asked President Bush what he had learned from this, and he said that life was unpredictable and fragile. I think that helped drive him. I think the idea that life could be taken away at any point was something that made him tireless in pursuit of what he wanted to do.
We're speaking with John Meacham on the Book Report.
When I was reading your book, almost in every page, I felt new respect for the man.
Oh, well, thank you. And I hope so. He's not perfect. He failed to understand the rhetorical requirements of his office. He didn't take the ongoing nature of politics seriously enough. When he decided to break his most memorable campaign pledge, no new taxes, for 3 days he didn't tell the country why. He learned very little about the bully pulpit from Ronald Reagan, which was striking since he was with him for 8 years. But he was his own man. He had a certain streak of pride and stubbornness that's manifested itself sometimes.
It certainly seemed that he was not Reagan's first choice as a running mate. How did their relationship evolve over the years?
Well, you know, Barbara was key to that. The morning after Reagan had reluctantly called George Bush, which was the day of the nomination for the Reagan-Bush ticket in 1980, Mrs. Bush walked up to Reagan and said, "Governor, you're not going to regret this. We're going to work our tails off for you." And Mike Deaver, who was very close to Nancy Reagan, later said that that was the smartest thing anyone could have said to him, said to Reagan right then. Bush won Reagan's loyalty by being tireless in his support of the administration, by never leaking, by never posturing. Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska sent word to Bush when he was vice president saying, "You need to separate yourself from 1600 on some issues." And Bush said that was bad advice, totally impossible advice. He saw his role as vice president being a senior confidential advisor. I don't think we fully know the advice he gave Reagan because he gave it to him personally and often verbally, but I think he was an effective vice president, and I know that President Reagan came to appreciate him in a very warm way.
How did he react as vice president to Al Haig's famous, "I'm in charge here"?
Well, Bush, it was March 30th, 1981, a Monday, and it was very early in the Reagan administration. All the cabinet members didn't quite have their sea footing yet. And Bush was on a plane coming back from Texas when Haig made that famous remark, sweating. I think Haig, to Haig's credit, was trying to reassure the European allies who did know him from the Kissinger-Nixon years. But Bush was flying back, realized that chaos was breaking out at the White House. The Situation Room was very chaotic. Reagan was at the hospital with Jim Baker and Ed Meese and others and Mrs. Reagan. And it's funny, Bush was like Fortinbras at the end of Hamlet. He walked into the Situation Room and immediately order was restored. The other thing he did, which seems like a small thing, but in the world of the White House was a very big, big thing, is he refused to land in a helicopter on the South Lawn. He refused to grandstand on that day. He wanted the focus to be on the president and the president's recovery.
With hindsight, how did he reflect on his choice of Dan Quayle as a running mate?
Well, he felt Quayle made a mistake. Quayle apparently...
Besides potato?
Well, besides potato was the least of it, believe me. What Quayle did is he apparently learned nothing from how George H.W. Bush had been vice president. Bush had never been a rival power center. Quayle and his staff positioned Quayle as the right-wing voice within the administration, leaked a great deal to the press, and it drove Bush crazy. But Bush, interestingly, never really directly confronted Quayle about it. Quayle told me when Bush got angry, he got quiet. And so you always had to kind of figure out why he was being quiet. He kept Quayle on the ticket in 1992 for two reasons. One was that to have removed him would have been an admission that he had been wrong in the first place, and that was that pride and stubbornness streak which we talked about. And the other was that having broken the Read My Lips, No New Taxes pledge, which enraged the conservatives in the Republican Party, but Bush decided not to do it.
You write the elder Bush has no time for the argument that his son was finishing his father's war. Talk about his statement, different war, different reasons.
Well, the George H.W. Bush's war with Iraq was a classic great power struggle. A nation had crossed a national border in violation of U.N. Regulations. The sovereignty of an independent nation had been violated. President Bush believed that had Saddam been allowed to keep Kuwait, it would have been a staging area for an attack on Saudi Arabia. He believed that an attack on Saudi Arabia by Saddam would have led to what he called a new world war, which is a phrase we didn't know until now that he had used about this. It was a phrase he used as he was dictating into his audio diary as the helicopter came from Camp David down to the White House. Right before Bush got off the helicopter on August 5th, 1990, it was a Sunday afternoon, he came down and said, "This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait," one of the two or three memorable phrases from George H.W. Bush. And he simply believed that he saw the first Iraq war through the prism of the Second World War, which was that Saddam was like Hitler. And if you didn't stop him early, larger problems would follow. George W. Bush's war was preventative, by definition. President Bush and the Congress, President Bush 43, and the United States Congress, including Senator Clinton, voted to launch an invasion against Saddam because they believed that he had weapons of mass destruction that could someday fall into the hands of terrorists. So that leads to President Bush's remark.
In watching the Republican debates right now, it's Jeb's...
Which is like watching professional wrestling, so I'm glad you're doing that.
Jeb is very lackluster. It seems like his heart is not in it. How is his father advising him?
You know, I don't think the president's advising him. I think he's being a supportive father. I think that George H.W. Bush played a bit of a larger role in George W.'s administration and some of those decisions than we've fully appreciated, and I try to lay those out. I think at this point, at 91, the president has vascular Parkinson's. He's in a wheelchair. Cognitively, he's all there. I think he's watching it with great interest, enormous interest, and a certain amount of concern since the Eisenhower campaign in Texas in 1952.
If you were interviewing him today, what would he have to say about the pool of candidates?
I think he would find Trump way out there. I think he'd find Carson way out there. And I think he would argue that Jeb has the experience, has the skills to be a great president. He told me that on a number of occasions. I do think the idea that Jeb was supposed to be president, quote unquote, is wrongheaded. I don't think the family ever sat down and had those kinds of conversations. I think the two older sons, George W. and Jeb, went into politics to pay homage, in part to pay homage to the most powerful and interesting man they'd ever known.
Final thoughts on the book and the man.
Thank you. I just hope that people read this book and will revisit an era only a quarter century ago where you had a president who put the national interest ahead of his own short-term political interest. George Bush would say and do almost anything to amass power. But once he had that power, he always did the right thing, and as he saw it. And so he opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, but in 1968, when he was in Congress, he voted for fair housing. He said, "Read my lips, no new taxes," but he struck a deal when he had to strike a deal. He ran a tough campaign in 1988, but created a culture of compromise in Washington that gave us the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act, the budget agreement, in a way that it's almost impossible to imagine the president and the Congress today of different parties cooperating. This is a vanished era on the edge of our historical and common memory, but it's a vanished era from which we can learn, and that is that presidents need to reach out. At some point, you have to make a decision for the governance of the country as opposed to the campaigns for office. And that's what George Bush did, and it's one of the reasons he was a one-term president.
Well, it was a fascinating book. I want to thank you so much for stopping by today.